when the administration circulated some fake video news releases to promote its prescription drug plan, some people described the practice as infoganda. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg wondered why the word propaganda wouldn't have covered the idea as well. As he reminds us, the history of that word reflects the changes in the way governments have learned to spin the news.
The public has gotten used to seeing advertisers ape news show formats in TV infomercials. So the Department of Health and Human Services must have been surprised when the General Accounting Office announced recently that they'd be investigating the department's use of the same techniques. The department had sent to TV stations a video news release to extol the virtues of the administration's prescription drug bill, complete with fake reporters and a shot of President Bush receiving a standing ovation as he signed the bill. On Comedy Central's Daily Show, one of Jon Stewart's mock correspondents described that kind of bogus newscast as infoganda and worried that it might drive genuine fake newscasts like Stewart's off the air. And in the New York Times last Sunday, Frank Rich extended the word infoganda to describe the range of ploys the administration has used to spin news coverage, from the editorial direction it offered to Showtime's movie DC-9/11 and the mission accomplished photo op aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln to the TV blitz by Condi Rice and others aimed at discrediting Richard Clark. Infoganda seems like a natural name for this sort of thing. It fits the pattern of those spliced-together portmanteau words like infotainment and docudrama. I think of those names as genre benders. It's the media version of junkyard wars. There's nothing new under the sun apart from what you can cobble together from the stuff that's lying around the shop. But what's curious about infoganda is that anybody would feel the need for a new word to describe those government-produced news videos. There was a time when propaganda would have done the job all by itself. The word propaganda was originally invented by the Jesuits in the 17th century to describe efforts to propagate the faith. But it didn't become part of the everyday vocabulary until the time of the First World War, when the British and Germans began to use the new techniques of mass advertising and public relations to rouse popular support for their cause. Americans got into that game when the country entered the war in 1917. President Wilson set up the Committee on Public Information, modeled on the British Department of Information. It became known as the Creel Committee after its chairman, the journalist George Creel. The committee churned out posters, pamphlets, and press releases. It enlisted 75,000 people to serve as four-minute men who gave short speeches at theaters and public gatherings urging people to enlist or buy liberty bonds. Most of that material was pretty purple stuff, laced with phrases like bombs or bondage and if you don't come across, the Kaiser will. But Creel denied that the committee was trafficking in propaganda. Our effort, he said, was educational and informative throughout. No other argument was needed than the simple, straightforward presentation of facts. As time went on, propagandists became more sophisticated at disguising their product. In 1938, one New York editor objected to the deluge of phony press releases from the so-called news services that were set up by foreign governments to win favorable coverage. He warned that they threatened to break down the line of demarcation between news and propaganda, particularly if papers began to rely on them to fill their pages. But by then it was clear that propaganda was most effective when it masqueraded as objective news. In 1941, when FDR wanted to drum up support for tilting toward the British side in the war, he set up the Office of Facts and Figures, headed by the poet Archibald MacLeish. New York's Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, who had been an advocate of the program, announced that the office is not a propaganda agency. We don't believe in this country in artificially stimulated, high-pressure, doctored nonsense. But in a private memo to Roosevelt, LaGuardia admitted that the agency's goal was to provide the public with what he called sugar-coated, colored, ornamental matter, otherwise known as bunk. Roosevelt's Office of War Information adopted the same principle in encouraging Hollywood to make movies that roused patriotic sentiments. As the agency's director Elmer Davis put it, the easiest way to inject a propaganda idea into most men's minds is to let it go in through the medium of an entertainment picture. Ultimately, the American propagandist's greatest victory was to discredit the word propaganda itself. By the time of the Cold War, propaganda only referred to what the other side said, and said crudely at that. The word conjured up the bombast and strident language of the fascist and communist, not the soft sell productions of our own side. Propaganda was stuff that played the Internationale in the background, not Stan Kenton. So it isn't surprising that the use of the word propaganda began to decline after the Vietnam War and tailed off sharply with the fall of communism. Over the last 5 years, it's been only a tenth as common in the press as it was in its Cold War heyday. That may be why people felt the need to coin the new word infoganda to describe the fake news shows and contrived photo ops that are designed to blend seamlessly into the media background. There may be nothing new about these techniques, but the current administration has used them more deftly than anybody since Roosevelt's day. And they found a fertile ground in the modern media setting, where the lines between journalism and advocacy and reality and fiction are already blurred. As a Department of Health and Human Services spokesman said in defending that fake news spot, anyone who has questions about this practice needs to do some research on modern public information tools. It's hard to argue with that. In a world of infomercials, advertorials, and docudramas, what's one more imposture?
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the forthcoming book, Going Nuclear. Please, don't correct me. That's the title. It's funny.